are focused on police legal relationships. They're all a little. Agent principal, employer employee. And the third one, independent contractor relationship. They're all terms I'm sure we're all familiar with. Starting with the agent principal relationship. An agent is a person that has agreed to act on behalf of a principal, which is somebody that he owes a bunch of duties to. Remember, duties from tort law. What are these duties that an agent owes a principal? Loyalty. Can't sell deals. Can't stand in the back. Confidentiality. And this legal buzzword, fiduciary relationship. Just like the bailment relationship that we've already talked about before. Remember the bailment, the trucker. Doesn't have to be a trucker, but it can be a trucker. It's anybody that agrees to hold property for somebody else. No consideration is a requirement for the bailment contract. In other words, it doesn't have to be a contract. Same thing with agents and principals. By the way, it's principal, P-A-L, note, not L-E, E-L-E. Same kind of spelling as the high school principal. You can agree, if the parties agree to have this relationship, they have it, even though the agent never gets paid. Doesn't have to be a contract. Now that doesn't mean that the principal can force the agent indefinitely to operate as his agent. Slavery went out, except for lawyers, as I said before, slavery went out with the 13th Amendment. It doesn't apply to lawyers, because the judge can make me do whatever the hell the judge wants. If the judge wanted me in court tonight, I'm in court. So, as soon as the agent says, I don't want to act as his agent anymore, the agent-principal relationship is over. Or as soon as the principal informs the agent, I don't want you to act as my agent anymore, the relationship is over. So, examples. I'm the agent of every one of my clients that I represent in my law practice. Sports agents represent athletes. The agent's purpose is the stockbroker is the agent for somebody who they're trying to invest their money for in the stock market. The fiduciary relationship. The agent has to act solely in the best interest of the principal. That's this duty of loyalty. So using that stockbroker example, if that stockbroker says, oh, geez, I think I want that stock. And I know he said he was looking for stocks in that particular business. Man, based upon what I know, I'm going to make a killing if I buy those stocks that he wanted me to get for him. That would be a breach of loyalty. If the agent did that, the principal, who would be the client of the stockbroker, could sue him.
How would you find that out?
A breach of the agency-principal fiduciary relationship.
How, as the principal, would you find out the agent?
Well, you have to prove it. When you're the plaintiff in a lawsuit, you've got the burden of proof. That's not a high number in a civil case. It's not a very high standard, as I want our judges to remember. It's only preponderance of the evidence. The plaintiff only has to be slightly more convincing than the defendant, and they win. Yeah, you might not be able to prove it. That's true. If the agent, back to that example again, if the agent discloses to the principal this information and says, you know, principal, if you're really not crazy about this business opportunity or this stock or this investment, I'll take it. Then there's no problem because he's disclosed it, he hasn't hidden it from the principal, and if the principal signs off on it, then the agent can take advantage of it, even though he only learned that information while acting within the agent-principal relationship. Then we don't have any problem with the breach of duties over here. The employer-employee relationship, totally different. The employer has the right to control the whereabouts of the employee at any particular time. Not so with agent principal.
You said slavery was going some time ago.
Pardon me?
So you said that slavery was going some time ago.
No, but they're getting paid though, it's not slave.
Indentured servitude.
Now they're getting paid. Of course, if they have an employee, you can quit anytime you want. Employer has a bunch of legal obligations as a result of the employee. Employer has civil liability for actions of the employee while engaging within the scope of the employment. That's not different than the first. That same liability exists up here. If the agent incurs personal liability while acting on behalf of the principal to a third party, the third party can sue the principal. Likewise, if the agent incurs expenses and costs acting on behalf of the principal, the agent has a right to indemnification or reimbursement, try not to use legal buzzwords here, reimbursement from the principal for costs and expenses the agent incurred while acting on behalf of the principal. That part's the same with employer-employee, these civil obligations and dealing with third parties. There's a whole bunch of other things that are different. Workers' comp. Employer has to carry workers' comp insurance on the employee. Unemployment tax. Employer has to take out unemployment tax and report to the state for the employee. Independent contractor relationship is different. Yes, Lucas.
On the employer-employee, you said at the beginning that they could declare where their employees were at.
Employer has a right to supervise the employee and determine where the employee is at any particular point in time.
Does that include to unpaid lunch breaks and or paid short breaks?
No. Good question. Because what some factory workers do is they go get drunk on their lunch break and come back. So if the employee is doing something to put themselves at risk in the plant on the lunch break, the employer has the right to control that.
Okay.
Tell you what, auto workers, they say they have a reputation for doing that.
What if, like, say you work at a restaurant and you go one of the, like, eat-up competitions, is that, like, is that anything like that or no?
No, generally speaking, when you're on break, well, the employer can't say whether you go off premises or not. I think they can say that. They probably have some control over when you go off premises. There's an articulated reason for that, though. Some kind of a reason.
And I got another question for you about that, too. Say you were...
It could be that every time they let them go off premises, they never come back on time. Maybe because of traffic or standing in long lines at restaurants, whatever the reason is. I don't want to get too far into that because we've got more kind of more important things to talk about.
And I got another question. Like, you said you know their whereabouts. Well, what if, you know how some places have the list of call-in lines, and if you're on the very bottom, if they call you on any given day that to come in, you know, you have to, like, you can come in and you get in trouble in your workplace. Is that anything like that or no?
You don't come in?
Yes. Say, like, you have a day.
We're going to talk about employees at will. Let's wait on that because I want to get into that. Another obligation, have to pay a minimum wage. What, $7.25 an hour? So these are all special things for employer-employee. Independent contractor. And I'm going to come back to that question. We have seemingly an employer-employee relationship, but not really. I'm going to put it together, because it can be very similar. Carpet and tile installers, notorious independent contractors, because the carpet and flooring retailers don't want to pay the unemployment tax and don't want to carry the workers' comp insurance. And I know a guy that's in his 60s. Got no retirement, got a very bad back from lifting those carpets around. But he's been an independent contractor almost his whole life. Well, Social Security also. I didn't mean to do that. That son of a gun has no Social Security paid in his system. He's got nothing. He's got no workers' comp, no Social Security, no pension, no nothing, go home. Don't pass go, collect $200, go home situation. That's sad. But flooring retailers, notorious for this. And so the employer pays the employee, supervises the whereabouts of the employee, so that much is the same. None of these other obligations. And the other thing is, the employer removes themselves from civil liability for the acts of the employee. And that's in the paperwork. So if you're going to have carpet and flooring installed at your house, read that paperwork carefully. Because in fine print, we are not going to say, we are not responsible for the actions of the installers who are not our employees, but it's a big favor we're doing to you to try to make it sound like. We've arranged your carpet installers. You don't have to worry about that. But they're not our employees. We want you to know that. So we are not responsible for their torts or their negligence. And anything else that they do, stealing, whatever they're going to do when they're in that house. This is also important in dealing with liability with third parties. If the independent contractors are over there working on the house, you're doing the work, you're not supervising them. You hire somebody to come, you hire an independent contractor to come and do work. They, all they have to do is the work as per the contract that you have with them. You agree on the materials, you're agreeing on what they're going to do, they determine what the work is. If you can't stand over their shoulder and tell them what to do because they're independent contractors. But if they incur torts, let's say it's your next door neighbor, the people doing the work are responsible, but not the people who sell them because they're independent contractors. Unless you know there's a dangerous condition on the premises, remember premises liability, way back to the first part of the class, social guests, business invitees, somebody that's over at your house for a business reason, you have a duty to fix the defects, you have a duty to warn. If you have reason to believe that there's dangerous work being done on your property that's not being done properly or the people who are doing the work are drunk, you've got a duty to go in and stop that from happening and get rid of them before something happens. Otherwise, you're going to be held responsible. You're going to be sued by your neighbors. Okay. We're talking about this concept known as frolicking detour. As it was known in common law. And that deals with this concept known as vicarious liability. The employer responsible for the employee, the principal responsible for the agent. For tort liability. But only as long as the employee is acting within the scope of their employment, under the control of their employer, and the agent only as long as the agent commits this tort while working on behalf of the principal. The principal is liable. Vicarious liability came as about most agents and employees don't have any money. So it doesn't do you a whole lot of good if you're an injured party, say, in a car accident. It doesn't do you a whole lot of good to be able to sue the agent. You want to be able to sue the party with deep pockets. Just like in the case we're going to do in class. It isn't going to do those people a whole lot of good if they can only sue Lindsay, the daughter that held the party. They can't get the parents that have the homeowner's insurance policy and tap into that. It doesn't do them a whole lot of good. And also to sue the guy that threw the punch. Just the working to do. Not a whole lot of money there. That's what this idea of vicarious liability. But if the employee or the agent, and this is the key point, the product in vitro, we do have a multiple choice question or a final exam on this. Well, we don't have any multiple choice questions. That's right. It's on the final
exam. Say we don't have multiple choice?
No, I think it's all short answers. It's like you're doing the legal wheel of fortune on a test.
Wow.
So product in vitro means that the employee or the agent remove themselves from the control of the principal or the employer and went off and did their own thing, then commit a tort, like a traffic accident or an assault battery or whatever it is. That takes the employer or the principal off the hook. when that happens. That's why you gotta be, you gotta be very careful. There's other ways for the employer to be liable to employ you. You gotta be really important if you're gonna be an employer and you're hiring. You've got to do background checks. With the software we have now, if you've got a date of birth, especially if you have a social security number, you can find anything you want about somebody. Any criminal case or civil case they ever had, how many times, who they've been married to, every car they've ever owned, every place they've ever worked, how they lost unemployment. If you hire somebody and you didn't do a background check and they ended up engaging in the same behavior that had you found out by doing the background check, you probably wouldn't have hired them. You're responsible for what they do on a theory of negligent hiring. Like you're hiring somebody to drive. I'm sorry, Joel. You're hiring somebody to drive, but you didn't check into their driving record. They got a horrible driving record. Negligent hiring. Joel?
Can a hiring agency do a background check on anyone anytime they want as long as they have their personal information? Shouldn't we have a right to...
Right to privacy?
Yeah, like at the end of an application, you sign it, and that gives them the right to do certain things. But I went in for an interview, and they'd already ran a background check and said, no, never mind, before I even give them any kind of consent.
I'm aware of a case. There's these people, these companies, these fly-by-night companies that want to compete with Consumers Energy. I don't know if you've had these people come to your door. They go door to door and they want to talk to you about an alternative energy plan that's going to save you money. Anybody like this come to the door?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we had a guy like this, went in and there was a woman at home by herself. And she let him in to talk to him about this alternative energy plan. Well, next thing you know, he commits criminal sexual conduct on it. Well, that company got sued big time. The theory of negligent hiring.
Well, I know there's a couple applications that I filled out that says by signing on the back page of this application, you hereby give us the right to do all the background checks and all this other stuff that we want, and all the information is true, and right on a big old paragraph in the back of the application.
If you go back to Frolic and Detour, so if I am driving somewhere for on behalf of my company, the company is liable. If I'm driving somewhere on my lunch break, they're not.
No. If you removed yourself from their control, if the company knows where you are and does not eject, they're still liable because you haven't removed themselves from your control, from their control. It's only when you vary from the route, you go where they don't know you're going, and you're not supposed to go there, and it's during your company time, and you commit a tort, you've let the company off the hook by doing that. You're going to be sued yourself.
Yeah.
You don't want to do that either because you're exposing your... Now, I want to talk about a couple of other things that come up in this. Very important. Especially those of you that are going to be agents. Your employees acting on behalf of your employees. Ratification, this term comes back to us again. And primary as opposed to secondary liability on a contract. First, ratification. Basically jumping through these agency chapters, trying to get everything covered in a short period of time here because of what we have left in the semester. If the principal does not know that an agent incurred a particular contract on his behalf, his or her behalf, until after the agent entered into the agreement, in other words, the agent went off and acted on his own, signed up a contract that the employer didn't tell him he wanted them to. The principal can still be liable on that contract if they ratify it after the fact. Ratification means that the principal informs that third party that the agent entered into a contract with and said, I accept this, I will be responsible for this. That's the ratification of the contract by the principal. Likewise, just the opposite. Let's say the principal fires the agent and says, I don't want you doing any more contracts for me, you're done. But the agent continues to go out and enter into contracts to try to stick the principal. That's where this idea of apparent authority talks about in the book. Three types of authority that an agent will have on behalf of the principal: actual, apparent, and implied. Well, the actual authority is the authority the principal gave the agent in the first place.
That's easy.
Now, this is what I want you to do. You go out and do this.
That's easy.
Implied authority is any authority that an agent in that particular industry would customarily be expected to have to be able to carry out their actual authority. Like maybe in a particular business, it's expected that the agent is going to wine and dine the customers, potential customers. Take them out to bars, get them drunk, take them out to Las Vegas on gambling weekends, take them to football games, buy football tickets and basketball tickets and all this stuff in order to get their business. The agent has implied authority to do that. The principal's got to pay, has to pay for it because the agent does have that implied authority. So we know what two of the three of them are. We know what the actual authority is, and now we know what the implied authority is, and this is the third, apparent authority. Apparent authority means that the customers and the third parties out there don't know that the principal has fired the agent. And they only agree to enter into the contract believing the principal to be liable. Why is that important? Because they never would have trusted the creditor if they thought they were only dealing with the agent. They never intended to enter into a contract just with that agent. And that's where this primary and secondary liability comes in. When the agent is acting solely on behalf of the principal, only the principal is supposed to have primary liability on the contract. This apparent authority of the agent to act on behalf of the principal continues until the principal notifies these customers, these third parties, clients, whatever you want to call them, that they have revoked the authority of that agent and don't act for the agent with the agent anymore. So if you're ever in that position where you have to fire somebody that's doing outside sales for you, you've got to send out a whole lot of letters and emails notifying every conceivable one of them, this person doesn't work for me anymore. If you enter into a contract with them, I'm not going to have primary liability on you. The apparent authority, again, lasts as long as everybody thinks that agent, reasonably thinks that agent is acting on behalf of the principal and hasn't been notified that the agent's been discharged.
You can say that if you have a salesperson working for you and you fire him, you need to send letters to
outside sales. Somebody who's out and about contacting, going to different places, and with your business cards trying to act on your behalf. Yes, you do.
So just by informing that guy that he doesn't work for you anymore, if he goes out and continues to make contracts with people, you're still responsible?
If they don't have any reason to believe that the actual authority has been revoked, yes.
The customer.
That's a common law rule. That's right. Got to be careful. Yeah.
So the Kirby salesman, if he got fired from his job, but the people still thought he was a door-to-door Kirby salesman, would Kirby salesman have to honor all those contacts? Like if they gave him a list of contacts to go out and try and sell to.
Right, because here's one of these situations that we have in the law. In this situation, it's between two fairly innocent parties. The one who fired the Kirby salesman and the customer at the door, someone's going to be stuck. Who should it be? Probably the one that was negligent in hiring this person in the first place to the point where they had to fire him. And they had reason to believe what his sales territory was. And with computers now, you can get things figure out and send out a mass mailing or mass email pretty easily.
So why isn't the agent that just got fired responsible?
He is. He is, but they don't have deep pockets. He's liable too.
Who cares if he's got deep pockets? He's the one that did something.
Yeah, but he's not the only one that's going to be liable. He's liable for the fraud he commits. Because that would be fraudulent misrepresentation. So he can be sued either by the customer or by the former employer. And so what you might have is you might have the customer suing the employer and you end up with three parties in the lawsuit.
So the customer is going to sue the employer for something that a non-employee did. That's basically what we're saying here. The customer is going to sue an employee or an employer for something that somebody did that didn't work for them.
Not necessarily. That's a little bit too broad, Mike. It depends on the situation. The length of time, 6 years later, you know, that isn't going to be the case. But the apparent authority of an agent to act on behalf of the principal continues until the customers or third parties are aware that this person no longer has actual authority. Now, it could be, the facts could be, that these people should already be aware of that. They may already know, and if they know, they can't hold them responsible if they have reason to know otherwise or independently that relationship no longer exists. So it's not quite that simple, but yeah, there is potential for that can happen.
So how would you go about go back to your energy example. You have an employee who goes door to door trying to scam you into buying their energy, comes into the house, commits criminal sexual assault, you fire them. And then the next day they put your suit back on and go to the next house and do the same thing. You can't reasonably notify everybody in Saginaw that there's some guy running around who used to work for you.
You put it in the paper.
No, this is the old common law rule. A lot of these common law rules are very rigid, and some of them don't make sense. The UCC changed some of them.
How would you defend against that?
First of all, if it wasn't negligent hiring in the first place, it wouldn't have happened. Somebody just doesn't all of a sudden start committing CFC crimes out of the blue, and there's nothing in the background to indicate that.
So
there's probably negligent hiring. If you know the neighborhood that this incident occurred in, then you go out contacting people in that neighborhood.
I'm not going to.
With a reverse phone directory. Does everybody know what a reverse phone directory is? A city directory? It lists everybody on the street with their phone numbers. That's what you got to do. Not the whole United States. But if you just send them out to a particular community and you said, we want you to go to, let's say, to the west side of Middle, try to contact everybody on the west side of Middle. Right.
Could you put it in the paper?
Back to this primary, secondary thing. If you're going to be the agent, have to be very careful when you sign something to make sure that you're not incurring contractor primary liability. Contractor primary liability means the person to whom you sign the contract with is going to hold you to this contract. You are going to be held responsible for this contract. If you're acting as an agent, you're not intending to incur personal responsibility for it. You're only intending to bind your principal or your employer. So whenever you sign, if you want to incur only a contract of secondary liability, which means the only way you would be liable is if the principal went bankrupt, you retain some of the consideration, and you can be sued for that, but only if the principal is out of the picture. Okay. You need to make sure when you sign, John Jones, as agent for, spell it right out on the document. And I don't care if there's not room on the printed contract, you make room. Because if you just wrote John Jones, Vice President of X Corporation, you're going to be held primarily liable on that company. All this is identifying who you are. If you only want the X Corporation to be responsible, you've got to say, John Jones, forget the VP, that's irrelevant. Just wants to make it look good. On behalf of, establish that agency relationship. The fact that you're only signing a contract of secondary liability, establish that on the document. Then you protect yourself. Because you're not, this signature, the person's not intending to incur a contract of primary liability.
So if X Corporation goes under, the agent can be held to be liable for that contract?
Not if he puts on behalf of X Corporation, or for X Corporation. I'm a big believer in using a lot of words to make it emphasis, okay? I'd rather say on behalf of, or strictly on behalf of, or only on behalf of, or I'd even add on there, by my signature, not attending contract of primary liability.
Were all those phrases essentially saying the same thing, that you're not intending primary responsibility? Okay.
Right.
All right, I just saw you change it. I'm just like.
Because otherwise, you're gonna take the risk that some judge later is gonna see this. They're not gonna know what's right. He's only gonna decide it based upon what's written down and what the common law says. I covered in half an hour those two chapters, 37 and 38, pretty much. Agents' crimes on behalf of the principal, never any implied authority to commit crimes. Okay? So you can't say, yes, I went out and killed that person, but only because that's what we do in this business, in this industry. No, that's never going to work. Can't do that. There was a supervision, there was a requirement, I can cover all of those two chapters. I'm just talking about disclosed and undisclosed principal in here. Talking about the same thing. At the time of signing a contract, the customer doesn't know that there is a principal. And so at that point, it's simply a contract of primary liability. But if after that, the identity of the principal becomes disclosed and they ratify the contract, that then lets the agent off the hook, and then only the principal is going to be primarily responsible. Okay, so how we're going to go from here is this. Next week, all you have is this test. And Brian and Gene, the young lawyer in the office, is going to be here, and I will not. Okay. We come back on April 4th. Landlord-tenant in real estate. This is the last area of this class. And that is, if I have time, I'll talk a little bit about decedent's estates. If I can reserve myself a little bit of time, this is chapter 52. So that's some interesting stuff in there. But real estate is what, 49? 49. And Michigan's landlord-tenant law, I'll have a handout for you on a Michigan statute. And we'll just have to talk about Michigan landlord-tenant law. That, the real estate chapter of 49, and if I have got time, the Stevens Estates. That stuff. Again, because we missed the class, there is no further test on this. That's, some of that stuff will be tested on the final exam.
So do you want me to tap it now?
Well,
can you cover it?